finished, everybody?
It's now El. Hopefully, you may see. Sorry for everybody. Time to get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ani l'dodi v'dodi li. It's a good thing to start off with the midst of Talmud Torah. And as El always starts, Shoftim v'shoshim titen l'chal b'chol b'sharecha. You have to put judges and watchmen posted in each and every gate. Certainly, the Bali Musar would see to it, you know, that we start Elul with taking proper precautions, everybody beginning to analyze themselves and to put up safeguards, you know, hold ourselves to a bit of a higher standard during this time of the year, hopefully, than the rest. And certainly, as the Saras Mei Tshuva continue, Mirza Shemal Bizoche, to Chesiv Chesim Tov. The Parsha definitely talks about Din. Because of this, as it starts, and it certainly talks about Shnayim Edim, that one of the ways that we enact din, judgment in court, the Beis Din is going to listen to two Edim, and two Edim, two witnesses are able to testify about pretty much anything, capital or civil cases. They are believed in both, whereas an Ed Echad, a solitary witness, is not going to be believed in capital or corporal cases. In civil cases, there is some weight given to that witness in that he can be mechayev shvuah. He can require the one who is going to be found somewhat incriminated, or maybe it's not incriminated isn't the right term here. The one who's going to be found liable may have to counter the witness by providing a shvuah, an oath. Either way, how do we deal with circumstantial evidence? So it would seem, off the bat, circumstantial evidence would be inadmissible. We need actual testimony. It is of note, you know, the witnesses could be lying. It is exeris a cost of two witnesses as opposed to 10 or who knows how many. You know, in the American court system, witnesses are certainly admissible, and it's up to the jury to determine, you know, even one witness can sometimes sway an entire case, and several witnesses sometimes aren't enough. The jury kind of makes their, you know, call, judgment call, based on do they think they're telling the truth or not. And, you know, what do they think they really saw? Were they misled on purpose, not on purpose? Or the judge, if it's not a jury trial. So we don't really have that to that degree. We have two witnesses coming in, and as is mentioned in many Rishonim, it's Exeris HaKosov. The Torah accepts two witnesses. It is Exeris HaKosov.
Well, we do Derashtan. We would do like the heart of it.
Sure. We require...
The judges suspect that there's some sort of...
Din Ruma. We'll get into Din Ruma soon if the judge, so to speak, smells a rat. You know, it sounds like something's wrong. Correct. But the number two is something that Kadosh Baruch Hu picked. Lahavdil, I think, from what I know, the only thing that requires two witnesses, if I'm not mistaken, is treason, which is in the Constitution itself. And just remembering that offhand, I could be completely wrong about that. It's been a long time since I've read it. You know, that number isn't really going to have any bearings elsewhere, at least outside the Torah, so to speak. It's something that's exeris HaKosov. So, it's interesting to see that the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Zayin, starts to address this idea. It's talking about capital cases. And it says that we like to really try to ascertain that the witnesses are telling the truth, and they have to know the severity of what they're dealing with here. They're somebody's on trial to be on death row, which there's not a very long time once the court case is finished, like there is in the United States. Once it's over, that's it. You know, it's not going to be that long until the person is actually, the judgment is carried forth. So that being the case, you know, we try to say, are you sure you saw it carefully? We really need to ascertain that they see it 100%. And one of the cases, which is a famous case, is that we compare it to, is the case of Rabbi Shimon ben Shattach. He saw an assailant, an alleged assailant, running after the victim, and he was running after them, presumably to try to stop them, and he saw the two of them enter into an area where they were secluded. There were no other exits. There was only one door into that room, that home, And he ran in a few moments later, and he saw the person who was running away, clearly the victim, convulsing on the floor, and a bloody knife, filled with blood, a bloody knife in the alleged assailant's hand. And he said, "What do you want me to do? I can't bring you to court based on this testimony because I didn't see the actual action." Now, there are no other exits whatsoever. So there's no other way that anybody else could have entered and killed this person. There's a remote possibility that the victim was running away and they caught up with each other, and immediately the victim grabbed the knife from the alleged assailant, killed himself, and the assailant picked it up. But that's something that's a very difficult circumstance. So either way...
That's not very reasonable.
It's not reasonable, I don't think. I think anyone would agree. But it's possible.
Maybe he was ready to commit suicide without her to stop.
And the guy was running with a knife.
Yeah.
He was in the middle of doing something. He was trying to cut the noose. Who knows? Once again, we don't know. But either way, that's the case. And Rabbi Shimon Shatach says, I can't bring you to court based on my testimony. Because I didn't see the actual Maisa, but may HaKadosh Baruch Hu, exercise judgment. And it wasn't long that a snake bit this individual and he died. So, the Rishonim were bothered that Shimon ben Shatach was by himself. So, even if he did see the actual action, he would have not been admitted into Beis Din because he's only one witness, not two. And Tosafos says there were other people with him, but he was very chashuv. So, when you talk about that, you don't usually talk about the other people who are accompanying the Gadol Hador. Shimon ben Shatach and Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabbai were the two, of the Zugos, if you read the Mishnah and Avos, those were the, so to speak, top two Gedolei Yisrael at the time. So the Talmidim, whoever was escorting him at the time, Tosfos assumes that they were there, and the Gemara just didn't reference them by name, because compared to him, they were, so to speak, Tafel. Not Batel, people aren't Batel, that's a Tumim, but they were Tafel to him. And the Rashba and the Ritva, they have other Tirutzim. But either way, the focus is really of the Sugya that that type of testimony is inadmissible, even though it's very compelling. Now, the Gemara assumes, this Mishnah that the Gemara was going on, which was discussing how do we strike fear into the witnesses, or really ascertain that they're telling the truth, and know that they saw 100% this action, the understanding of the Gemara is that this seems to be something specific to dinei nefashos, to capital cases, but not specific to dinei mamnas, the civil cases. So initially the Gemara assumes that, what we're dealing with here, since the application was the dinei nefashos, the capital cases, that this type of testimony would in fact be admissible in a civil case. The Gemara wants to know who is the author of this Mishnah, because there's the idea of umdina, something, an evaluation or an estimation, or what we would call to a degree circumstantial evidence, although compelling, it says the author, initially the Gemara says the author of this Mishnah must be none other than Rabbi Acha. Rabbi Acha does in fact state that this type of evidence is admissible into Beis Din, and therefore it must be, the Rabbi Acha says it's admissible, that's only by civil cases, and when it comes to capital cases, Rabbi Acha would not have this, because the Rabbanan, the assumption is, would not allow, even in a civil case, this type of evidence. So since the Rabbanan do not allow it even in a civil case, this Mishnah indicates that this is specific to a capital case. So therefore, it must be Rabbi Acha, who we know does allow for this type of evidence to be admissible into civil cases. It must be he draws the line and does not allow it for a capital case. So we have what appears to be two opinions. That's how the Gemara seems to address that. Then the Gemara ends up saying, no, it can even be the Rabbanan. And it works it through. And the Rabbanan do still say that it's inadmissible both by civil and capital cases. So on the surface level, what seems to come out from this sugya is the Rabbanan do not allow this evidence in any type of a case, at least civil, corporal, or capital.
What do you mean by corporal?
Malchus. To whip the person. So it's inadmissible for any type of those cases. Whereas the we have what appears to be Rabbi Acha, who would say that when it comes to civil cases, it's fine, and anything more than that, we assume it would not be, or certainly at least capital. Malchus is not so clear what the Gemara is dealing with. Maybe Malchus, yes, maybe not, I'm not sure. That's a different, thing to discuss. Either way, the problem is that we have a Gemara in Shavuos that indicates that even Rabbi Acha Rabbi Acha even allows this type of evidence to be admissible even for capital cases.
Circumstantial evidence.
Very compelling circumstantial evidence. Keep in mind, in the United States and in, I believe, most Western countries, there's a point when it's up to the jury, but there's a point when there's enough circumstantial evidence that it's considered not reasonable. It's an unreasonable doubt. I think we all could agree that to assume that that person committed suicide would be an unreasonable doubt. Now, maybe there would be, we would allow, let's say we then have testimony that this person had no history of mental illness and had no history of depression or whatever else. So the likelihood that a person like that, it could happen that the person was hiding it, and was suicidal, nobody knew. It does happen, unfortunately. But taking that into account with the whole other event, and who knows what other, at what point do you say is reasonable? At one point it's an unreasonable doubt, even though it's inadmissible, because they didn't see the action itself. It's possible that he committed suicide, or maybe who knows what else could have happened in that room. Certainly the Gemara indicates the fact that it brings the following part. Reb Shimon Shattuch had no doubt what occurred. He basically said, let Hashem take judgment from you. Now, it could be that there's nothing wrong with saying that, because if you're innocent, so Hashem will take judgment, so to speak, and will find you innocent. But then the Gemara's next part of it wasn't long before a snake killed him. It's not 100% from the story, but it seems that the Gemara is saying it's an unreasonable doubt. Nevertheless, it's inadmissible. Rabbi Acha would allow at least for that, an unreasonable doubt, to be admissible into Beis Din. So how do we reconcile the two sugyas? So Tosos, Rashba, and pretty much all the Rishonim give the same answer. And that is that there was no source that said straight out that Rabbi Acha does not allow for circumstantial evidence to be admissible, or at least extremely compelling circumstantial evidence to be admitted into Beis Din for capital cases. We had an issue. Rabbi Acha does have a case in Shas where he actually, his opinion is stated, and it's a case of civil, it's a civil case. It's a case of a camel that damaged another camel. So that's the case that Rabbi Acha actually stated. We then had a Mishnah that made it seem that there's somebody who allows for civil cases for this type of evidence, but not capital cases. The Rabbanan don't allow it anywhere. So the only person who could theoretically have fit that mold was Rabbi Acha. We don't know for sure that he disallows the evidence to be admitted into for a capital case. It theoretically could be that way, but since there's no other candidate who could have authored that Mishnah at that Hava Mina of the Gemara, that stage of the Gemara, so we assumed it was Rabbi Acha. But once the Gemara ends off saying that it's even possible it's the Rabbanan, and that sugya is not exclusively talking about capital cases, it just happened to also be talking about it, which we mentioned. The Gemara ends up saying, no, it really could even be the Rabbanan in that case. We no longer are forced to say that Rabbi Acha only applied his case to civil cases, because we don't necessarily have to have that Mishnah being given in Sanhedrin. And therefore, since we don't have anywhere explicitly, Rabbi Acha explicitly stating that he disallows it in a capital case, therefore we assume that his evidence is considered evidence wherever, both in capital and in civil cases, and that's what the Gemara in Shavuos is in fact the maskana, so to speak. Once we've resolved our issue in Sanhedrin, Shavuos is predicated on Rabbi Acha's actual shita, which means Rabbi Acha allows circumstantial evidence to be, compelling circumstantial evidence to be admitted into Beis Din in all cases, and the Rabbanan disallowed in all cases. That's what seems to come out from the Gemara in Shavuos. Now, let's just point something out. Rabbi Acha, regardless of what we discussed in last week's shiur, holds of the Torah. I think we can all assume that. Now, the Torah says you need two witnesses. So what's going on? Forget about the Rabbanim for a second. How does Rabbi Acha look at the pasuk? Now, here's something else just to throw out there for a second. The Torah uses similar language by civil and capital cases, two or three Eidim. What's the Havamina of the Gemara? Assuming somehow we can read circumstantial evidence into this case of two or three Eidim, right? Assuming we can read it into there. So, if it's admissible in one, somehow it fits into the language of that, then it's admissible into both. We have the same language used in the Torah by both civil and capital. What's the difference? So, Elamai, one of two things. Either the pasuk is telling me about testimony, but it's not talking about evidence. Meaning, evidence is somewhat facts. Once they're shown, we have recordings, we have DNA, we have who knows what else. It doesn't lie. Now, it might not tell the full truth, in that it might not get you the exact action that happened. Then you have to make an assessment whether it's reasonable or unreasonable that the event occurred. But it's not testimony. We're dealing with hard facts. If we have blood found, or let's say we have skin found under the fingernails of the victim, so we can take that and analyze that, and we do a DNA test, and we find out the possible assailant, the alleged assailant, it's his skin. The DNA isn't lying. Assuming that DNA and the testing of it is considered accurate, which is pretty accurate, and assuming that the people involved in testing were not kosher, that they contaminated the sample. That being the case, it doesn't mean that he killed him, but we can ascertain that his skin somehow got under the fingernails, which does look like we can make an assertion. Maybe there was a struggle, and in the fight, a little skin got caught under the fingernails. Whatever it is, but that's where I now make my assessment. Witnesses aren't hard facts. I'm listening to somebody recount a story. So it's possible that when the Torah says, Al pi shnayim eidim o shlosha eidim, that it's not talking about the admissibility of other evidence. It's just saying, the Torah is telling me that Hashem allows for testimony, because you could have thought that testimony is inadmissible completely. Because maybe everybody is lying, it's collusion, they're all paid off or who knows what else, or they hated the guy and they want to frame him, right? So maybe testimony is completely inadmissible. So the Torah is telling me, two Eidim, and then the drasha, why three? If you already have two, fine, you can deal with it, but it's telling me the minimum Eidim, the amount of witnesses necessary, but it's not excluding it, perhaps, from other types of evidence that will be admissible. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that the word Eidim means a level of proof. Shnayim or Shlosha Eidim is telling me, since the general aspect of it, or the standard, is that it's talking about witnesses, so two witnesses usually hold a certain level of nemanus. It's more likely that two people who happen to be telling you the same story are telling the truth than one person. That two people could get the story so perfectly together without tripping up, etc. It's possible they're lying, but it's not as likely as one person coming in. And forgetting about lying, certainly having a faulty memory. If two people have the same exact recounting, forgetting about whether they're lying, one person could have forgotten, a detail, mixed something up. If two people have it, it's less likely that that occurred. So if what we're doing is it is talking about evidence, but maybe it's only giving me a level, which is hard to quantify. What are we going to say on a 1 to 10? It's a number of what? It's hard to quantify, but maybe that's what it's doing, and it's non-specific. Either way, if it's the first way, then Rabbi Acha is fine. Because the pasuk isn't telling me about evidence. Why he differentiates between capital cases versus civil cases is unclear, but it's not having anything to do with these psukim. If it's that it's telling me a level, then the level applies across the board. It's the same language is used. So the truth is, it's somewhat irrelevant. It's just a nice academic exercise to show you in the pasuk how either way could be possible, and it's something maybe, you know, somebody might want to look into. But either way, you're going to need another Xeris HaKosuv. You're going to need some reason to tell me that we're more strict by Dine Nefashos. And once you have that, in either case, it can tell me that even though two Eidim are admissible, a certain level of testimony, nevertheless, there's still some other element that we scrutinize it with greater detail. So the two Eidim that are admissible into a capital case have to be a better two Eidim, so to speak, than a civil case. Meaning we hold them to a higher standard. With people, it might not be as applicable, but with evidence, it certainly would be. Either way, what would that come from? One possibility is the pasuk tells me, v'tzilo eda, that there's a responsibility on the population to give the best possible defense to save the life of the alleged murderer, Michal Shabbos, whatever other capital case we're talking about.
This would be a mitzvah sasei now?
That's a mitzvah sasei to save him. If we can find any reason to save him, v'tzilo eda. And we take great strides to do that. There are many things that we do in order to enable that. Certain things that, you know, if an entire basin, keep in mind you need a panel of minimum of 23 for a capital case. If the entire basin finds him guilty, he walks. Because it's too unlikely that not one person could find something, we think something's up. So he walks. Whereas if they all found him innocent, we don't retry. If you want to find him, you only need a margin, you know, as you go by majority, right? You need a majority of at least two in order to find him guilty. But to find him innocent, you only need one. So we do have a higher standard to find him guilty.
The margin of two is weird because you can never have it.
So Gemara discusses
13-10.
Correct. So the Gemara discusses exactly what you're talking about, and
that's just weird language.
Wait, well, yes and no. The Gemara in Sanhedrin asks and tries to find the case when it actually can happen. If one judge basically says I'm out because I can't render a decision, then you start adding extra people. There are all sorts of cases. The Gemara in Sanhedrin does try to find your case to find
the
legal
case.
They have to start adding to the basin. They have a panel. In other words, when you have basin, besides the actual panel that the people are testifying in front of, there are alternate juries, jurors, so to speak. Meaning, sitting in front of the basin, you have potential Dayan who are also listening. They're not the ones who are actually adjudicating. They do go and convene with the rest of the Dayan because they may be necessary.
There's never more than 23 voters.
There can be, because you always add two.
If one person abstains, you add two to replace it.
And then you might need to add more if there's a basin, a shakel, if you have an even basin. That's what Gemara talks about, how many you add in each case. In order, you always need an odd number of judges. So that's how the Gemara starts to get into whether you could have two. But you're right. I mean, on the surface level, it seems you shouldn't have two. That's Gemara and Sanhedrin. Either way, back to this. So, what's interesting is the Rambam tells us in Sefer Mitzvahs in Mitzvah Reish Tzadi. So he says from Parshas Mishpatim, obviously Mitzvahs say, excuse me, Losa say. I say wouldn't get that high. So he tells me that it says that a Naki, a person who's innocent, or tzaddik, cannot be killed. Yes, but he's telling me, of course, why am I going to kill? And it seems like we're talking about a court case, and it's telling you don't kill an innocent person in court. So what's going on here? Of course, that's obvious, that's murder. So he says that this is an explicit issur. What's talking about is this, exactly what we're talking about. That the Beis Din will have circumstantial evidence. Now, clearly, Rabbi Acha is not dealing with this to this degree, because he allows for some element of circumstantial evidence, But at least this would have told us why initially we thought Rabbi Acha would differentiate. But you cannot allow for circumstantial evidence. Why? Because if you do, even though it's an unreasonable doubt, says the Rambam, so next time, you know, the next time there's a case or another panel of judges or another based in will have the legal precedent from this one, then everything's recorded and they'll learn from it and they'll move the line over a little bit. So this basin was an unreasonable doubt to the 10th, you know, degree, the next one is to the 9th, and pretty soon it kind of keeps moving over and over a little bit each time without the recognition that it's, you know, the bar has been lowered, until at one point it's possible that we really may kill an innocent person. And the Rambam says it's better that 1,000 guilty people should walk, he didn't say walk, should be zakai, he says should be found innocent, than for one innocent person to ever be killed. So that's what the Rambam says. So we see another issue besides Yitzilu Eda, we see specifically when it comes to capital cases, we really have to scrutinize because we have to make sure that the evidence is proper, and therefore the Rambam, that's where he says this rule comes from for Umdana, that we disallow the circumstantial evidence. That's where a separate Isser that would be you know, on the basin if they should use circumstantial evidence to find somebody guilty. And he actually brings the case of Rabbi Shimon ben Shatach, which you mentioned from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that you know, the case where he ran after the person. So it would seem off the bat, since presumably we hold like the Rabbanan, which we'll just assume for right now, that, you know, it's inadmissible, and since the Gemara concluded it's inadmissible both for capital and for civil cases, then it's completely inadmissible. What's pretty fantastic is that there's a case in the Gemara where we find, similar to Rabbi Shimon ben Shatach's case, one person running after another, and the witnesses come in a few seconds later, and they notice that he didn't kill the guy, but he hurt him. He wounded him. So we're talking about now a civil case, because we're talking about monetary damages. And he hurt him in an area that it's impossible for him to have done to himself. For example, don't try this right now. Trust me, you can't do it. He has a bite mark on his elbow. It is impossible for a person to bite his own elbow. You can't reach. Maybe Harry Houdini or somebody who's ridiculously flexible, I don't know. But normal people are unable to bite their elbow. And therefore, the Gemara says, in such a case, the ruling will be that the person's found guilty. Oh, that's a civil case, which I would think should be different. You know, that, excuse me, should be inadmissible. Such a, the Adam didn't actually see what happened. They saw him go into the room, and then boom,
there's a bite mark. There's no other possibility, so.
There's no other possibility, so is that different? But it's not Adam. So what's going on? That's a great point to differentiate. So this case is brought within the context, especially when the Rambam brings it. There are a few cases, one after another, where there is a takan that Chachamim made because things perhaps are getting out of hand a little bit. In order to kind of push back, there were some people, some tough guys, who got their way. They would rough people up to get their way, scare them into doing what they needed, business, who knows what else, some mafiosos. So the ruling became that if somebody was injured and there were no witnesses, he could take a shvua, holding the Sefer Torah or some other, you know, chefetz like that, and be able to be paid by the assailant, alleged assailant. It's clearly a knas. It's clearly a fine. The Rambam says it before. She says, in order to get at these people who are strong-arming people, so Chachamim instituted a knas, this fine, that they allowed for victims to get money from their alleged assailants with a shvua. Now, obviously, somebody who's chashed al shvua, somebody who's suspect to swear falsely, is not going to be allowed to do this. So we're assuming that, you know, we're dealing with people who are at least considered to be that reputable, that they would not take a shvua an oath, you know, falsely. So this case does not have a shvua, and doesn't explicitly say that it's a knas. Are the two together? That's something that needs to be addressed. Tosfos, let's go away from the Rambam for a second. Tosfos says that the same thing would be applicable. We have the same exact issue. If a Rabbi Shimon ben Shatach case, two guys ran into the, you know, the house, there are no other exits, and the witnesses come a few seconds later, and the person's dead. Tosfos says we would in fact try the murderer, and we can put him to death. The case there is, he has a bite mark through his skull. That's a pretty powerful bite. But either way, if you think it's impossible to bite your elbow, it's certainly impossible to bite your own skull. So, that being the case, says Tosfos, Tosfos is clearly not assuming that it's a knas. He's, because you can't have that, just a fine, you know, punitive damage. You can't have that in a capital case. This is real testimony. So obviously Tosfos assumes one of our two options from before about Apishnaim Edim, that either it's only regarding testimony, but other things weren't necessarily excluded, or it's talking about a certain level of testimony, and we allow, you know, two witnesses is the Pshuto Shomikra, and therefore it's Xeris Gosa that they're allowed, even though we know they could be lying. Either way, that's what he says. So the Ramah, before we get back to the Rambam, the Ramah does something interesting, and he says it's admissible for civil, but inadmissible for capital cases. Okay. So already, just the fact that it's Machlokas Rishonim, one would assume that in today's day and age, if we were to be able to try capital cases, assuming the Sanhedrin, which would have to be around again, would not decide to you know, decide between the Rambam and Ramah, and see, you know, passing the halacha one way or another, assuming they would keep both, so to speak, on the table, we would say safek nefashas lahakal, it's a safek in din, whether we pass on like the Rambam or Ramah, and therefore presumably it would be inadmissible for a capital case. But for civil cases, both the Ramah and Tosfos, and possibly the Rambam, would agree. Now, what does the Rambam say? We mentioned him before. It's a little unclear. Many Achronim do assume that the Rambam just includes this and it's just a knas like the others. Just like the first case we said with an oath is a knas, some Achronim assume that this also is, and Rambam is arguing with Tosfos, and therefore it is going to be, even by a civil case, a machlokas Tosfos and the Rambam. I think, though, I mean, if you look and you really analyze it really closely, it seems very clear the Rambam separated the two. There are different halachas, even though they may be in the same parak. And the wording of knas is only by the first halacha of the one with the shvuah, where anything could have happened. And therefore, this case was not a knas, and it actually would be halachically binding, and he would allow that panel to judge that person. What would he say by Sakharis Nefashis? By a capital case. By Dine Nefashis. What would the Rambam say? Assuming, which I'm asking, we found the Chronim who say the Rambam does not allow this for civil cases, it's just a knas also, and that knas is when it's impossible in another way. What would the Rambam say in a capital case? Well, if it's admissible, it's admissible. But what do we do with that Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvahs? So, perhaps, the Rambam said very clearly, one basin will learn from the other. The example he gave was Rabbi Shimon ben Shatach's case, which is not impossible to have been done in a different fashion, albeit it was unreasonable the person killed himself. And therefore, it's reasonable that the Rambam would not apply that halacha to a case where it's impossible to have been done in another fashion. So it seems to me that the Rambam would allow, like Tosfos, would allow this to occur in a capital case. He would allow this testimony, DNA evidence, perhaps, if it's, you know, we know it's not contaminated, it's not monos from the way it was collected, etc. it would be allowed to be done. Now, keep in mind, certain things are unreasonable, even though they theoretically could have happened, and we don't allow them into court. For example, how do we know that a second before he stabbed him, some meteorite flew down from space, hit the guy right in the spot, and you know, then he was dead, and then the blood splattered on the knife? It's possible, right? How do we know it didn't just open? You know, somehow, who knows? He it ripped on its own. He had something there from beforehand. He was a trefa, so to speak. He had a hole there, a prior injury that we didn't notice. How do we know that? In the case of the Gemara might say, but does not. How do we know a shade didn't come and attack him and then disappear? Who knows? Right? So, I think the answer to that is, if two witnesses would have seen it, any of those events could have had, maybe not the meteorite, depends how fast it was and how quick their eyes are. But, at least the other cases, they wouldn't have seen it. It would have been a split second, they wouldn't have known the difference. If he had a prior injury and they didn't notice it, we don't address that. Anything that two witnesses, because the Torah tells me you can adjudicate based on two witnesses. So anything that if two witnesses would have seen the actual ma'isa, we would not allow in court. So the fact that you have compelling evidence, not just circumstantial, actual evidence, just not testimony, will still be admissible. Because if Adam actually saw the event, any of those things could have occurred, and we still would not have allowed them to be suggested in the courtroom. So that seems to be what comes out. Now the Rosh, interestingly enough, there are some Achronim who maintain that he passes like Rabbi Acha, but most Achronim don't seem to learn that way. It seems very difficult, really, in some of the Pesachim to state that. There's one tshuva of his that's a little ambiguous, the language in it, and that's why they attribute to him like passing like Rabbi Acha. Although from the other places where he explicitly discusses it, it doesn't seem that's the case, and therefore from one ambiguous passage to others which are pretty clear-cut, I would, you know, say I'm not sure exactly how to read that tshuva, but you know, take what's clear-cut and use it. Just one more sheet, the Morche does possibly Rabbi Acha. But either way, the majority of Rishonim do not pass on like Rabbi Acha, they go like the Rabbanim. Now there's another thing, just to bring forth, and that is the Rambam does mention what you mentioned earlier, this idea of if the Dayanim see that something seems really wrong, something really seems like they're lying, they can override to a degree the court case, and they can throw out testimony and deal with things a little bit in that fashion, and that's, you know, something that the judge is empowered to do. So perhaps it does seem. Let's go to a different tshuva for a second, written by Rav Moshe, about a different topic. It's an individual who his parents were not religious, and he became religious. His parents did not keep kosher, but he did. And he wanted to know, can he eat in his parents' home? Now, generally, a mashgiach is inadmissible if they themselves don't keep kosher. We don't assume that they're trustworthy to a degree because they themselves don't really find that as a severe infraction should they not, you know, keep kosher. And therefore, to give it to somebody else, they don't really see anything major happening. Here, this person, it's a major issue, and Baruch Hashem, with the you know, explosion, so to speak, the Baal Tshuva movement, as they call it, you know, in the generations, our generation, the generation before us, etc., it's a very common child that really needed to be addressed. So Rav Moshe says the person is possibly allowed to, depending on, and he learns it from a case in the Gemara where Rava, in a court case, sided with somebody, Basra Chis's daughter, and actually leaned the court case a little bit based on her testimony, even though you know, she should not have been admitted into base, and certainly not to a strong degree, based on the circumstances and based on her admissibility as a witness. But Rav Moshe says, you know, there's sometimes when you know somebody, you just know it. It's not that I know that they're a good person, good character. I know, because of everything I've heard, that Moshe Rabbeinu, I assume he would not lie. But if he came into my basin, which I don't have a basin, but if I had a basin, if he came into my basin, I would not be able to give Moshe Rabbeinu more credence than anybody else. But people I know on a personal level, and the reason I know they're not lying is because I know them. I know them well. I can't allow them to be like too aided, but I can at least give them a little more weight than other people. They have a little more nemonis. So that, what Moshe says, is admissible, so to speak. That's what the Gemara over there, he assumes, is talking about. And therefore he says, if this person knows his parents and he knows they're not going to give him treif, then he's allowed to rely on them. Now, obviously in a case like that, it's always important because they may not know all the rules, so to just be very specific with food preparation, but assuming he knows that that is what occurred and there's no problems with it, Rav Moshe mattered in situations like that. You know, there's a Ma'arik that seems to be addressing the same issue, and he says that there are certain things, really when it comes to human behavior, that judges have to make the call. You ever wonder, what's an Anan Sadi? The Gemara is an Anan Sadi all over the place. You know?
It's obvious, it's pretty clear.
But it's not witnesses. But we allow it as a witness. What an Anan Sadi means, literally means, Anan Sadi, we testify. We, the Beis Din, are testifying. Meaning, people act in a certain way. And when somebody's actions are going so clearly against normative behavior, it's so unlikely that the person did it, we assume that normal behavior really occurred. Meaning, sometimes we have a circumstance and we don't know the person's motive. Or somebody gave a present and we don't know what he really meant. Sometimes in order to make a kinyan, to have a transaction really be binding, there are certain parameters that are necessary to be met. But somebody on his deathbed, we forego those, oftentimes. Why? Because we know on his deathbed his mind isn't 100%. He's very nervous about all the things happening. He also wants to make sure to get everything done and give to whomever he wants his estate before he passes. So we forego certain things because we know what he's doing. And we also know it's not really likely that he's lying. So we have an Ansadis in many circumstances. The Ur Zeruah discusses that an Ansadi essentially is a ruba de leisa kaman, meaning a rove, a majority, that we can't really quantify. We just know most people act in a certain way. We never poll the entire population of mankind. So we don't know for sure, but behavioral patterns work that way. The Ur Zeruah says that is what an Ansadi is. It's a ruba de leisa kaman, it's a rove, that's not quantifiable because we don't have an actual poll of all the people in the world. But in our sampling, not necessarily that it was done with an actual statistic, but based on our knowledge of human behavior, most people act a certain way. When it's a very compelling most, then it takes the status of an Anansadi. And there are some places in Shas where at least they entertain the possibility, even if it's rejected, that we assume nobody does it in another way. And therefore, if you have certain ones, the Gemara rejects it eventually, but certain things with a woman, we don't know if she was entitled to 200 zuz or 100 zuz in her ksuba, whether she's a basula or an almana from beforehand. So if she went to her wedding dressed in a hinuma, whatever that is, which was only done for women who had never been married before, so initially the Gemara says any girl who went out like that is a basula. And therefore is entitled to 200 zuz, and if the ksuba is not around now, and they're getting divorced, or the husband died, we'll grant her 200. The Gemara says, well, if it's 200, and you have witnesses coming to testify against, and you're telling me everybody who goes out with a henuma is certainly a basula, so throw out the witnesses. The Gemara actually entertains throw out the witnesses, because it assumes it's so compelling. It says, no, we didn't mean everybody, we meant most people. So it's an anansati. These anansites are normative behavior. So we see this type of evidence is also admissible in the Beis Din, where we know people act a certain way, so now we need to understand motives, or whether a person like Gmir Stas, they really intended to do what they did. We understand people to a degree. So when we know people act a certain way, we can attribute to them, even though we don't know for sure, certain motivations and certain understandings. So that's something that is admissible. That's an Anansadi, as the Ur Zeruah says. The Ma'arik is also discussing this. That's really where Rav Moshe is coming from to even discredit or give more credit to certain witnesses and other events in the basin. The Rosh applies this to a rule called Kol Da'olam Gevar. Kol Da'olam Gevar is a situation, sometimes two people come into Beis Din, and let's say they're both holding on to an item, and each is claiming it's his. So in such a case, we generally split it in half. Shnayim Ochsim B'Talos, some of us are familiar, this is Mishnah. So they're both holding on to a talos, we don't know whose it is, so we split the talos in half. That's how they're entitled to it, or maybe one guy can purchase out the other guy's share if they don't want to split, whatever it is. Sometimes, when they're not necessarily holding on like that, we say, Kol Da'olam Gevar. Whoever can overpower the other. Some learn that means, listen, duke it out, so to speak, in Beis Din. The Rosh learns that means duke it out. Take it out in the back alley and see who wins. And whoever wins takes it. What? Because the Rosh says, when somebody really owns property, and he came to Beis Din, and somebody else is contesting it, the one who's the true owner will be Moser Nefesh. He'll really give it his all in the fight, and the other person won't. So call Talmud Gemara. But what it means, the way he words it, is it's not just Beis Din saying a siluka din, as some say, different Mishnah in a different way. It's not a siluka din according to the Rosh. It's not that Beis Din saying, we're not ruling on this, we can't deal with this, figure it out amongst yourselves. It's saying, the way we are going to figure it out is whoever wins is assumed to be the owner based on human behavior.
It's like a boat, I think, floating in the water.
Ahu arba, that's the case, right? The case of an arba, the boat. That's the general case of Kol Da'olam Gevar.
And whoever assumes their first wins.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's this Kol Da'olam Gevar. Whoever overpowers, whoever gets it first, whoever takes out the other guy, whatever. That's how the Rosh discusses it. It's interesting to note, let's go to Shlomo HaMelech for a second. The famous case, the two women, two zonos came in. It's my kid. Split the kid. Then one says, no, don't do it. Oh, she's the one. So Zan Achronim ask, why did he say split the kid? That's Shnayim Ofsim Metalos, but only one was holding it. Okay, so the Akedah actually says it. If you're both holding, then split the kid. If not, not. Like, what are you doing? One woman was holding it. So they address what's going on in their own way, but the Abarbanel says that, you know what? From the way they even said their tightness, from the way they made their statements, Shlomo already knew who the rightful mother was. And he just wanted to show everybody else so that there would not be a way for anybody, to have issues with the judgment. Because if he would just rule but not be able to support his claim, so then everybody would say, well, what are you doing? You want this one, you want that one?
But how does he rule without witnesses?
Okay. So that's what we're dealing with.
Isn't that king's prerogative?
So that's another issue, whether a king can have prerogative, and that's Iran, perhaps, that maybe a king does have prerogative to have a different judicial system. We talked about that a while ago, I think, when discussing whether, even nowadays a basin has that element and they can actually maim or kill people, not within accordance with the Torah. Which they may have some authority.
Without due process.
Without a lot of things. I mean, without even an aveira that would normally be deserving of that. And we talked about Mara Mulublin, and we talked about that was a while ago. But correct, it's possible that's the case. But the Barbanel is saying he's not going that route necessarily. He says he already knew from their tightness, he already knew who was the rightful one, he just had to prove it. Now, he doesn't say what. If you ask me, I'm not Shlomo Melech, that's for sure. But I would think, if you look, one woman says, her son's dead, mine's alive. The other one says, my son's alive, her son's dead.
That's not the way the pasuk writes.
That's the pasuk. That's the pasuk. So I think that it's possible, although I don't know for sure, it could have been tenuous the way they were acting, their facial expressions, whatever. The Barbanel seems to definitely say it's that, but I think even from the Tanya itself, I don't know how compelling I would think or if I would feel as comfortable with Shlomo Melech. He's certainly saw more. But you see what the person really wants. One person, it was more important that the other person's son be dead. She said that first. She was just jealous. The other woman couldn't have a kid if her kid, unfortunately, it was a very unfortunate situation. Nebuch, the child was smothered in the middle of the night. But it was more important to her, her son is dead, mine's alive. Whereas the one whom Shlomo Melech really ruled with in the end, she said, my son's alive, it's her son that's dead. Her focus was, give me my kid, my kid's the live one. The other kid, Nabuch, it was a horrible situation. I don't know whether that's it or not, but either way, it definitely does seem to be the same idea. If it was a din melech, then you're right, as you're saying. If it was a din of the melech has the ability to override it. But certainly within these achronim, they were definitely saying that it was a ruse to show the rest of the court that he was right. And he really already knew it. And that's the case. You know, there are other cases we can go into. It's getting late now, so maybe we'll stop here. But in a nutshell, those are different elements of circumstantial evidence or evidence which isn't circumstantial, but non-testimonial evidence that is admissible in Zebesim. We've seen different chilukim amongst different rishonim, capital, criminal, or civil. The Ramah, as we said, did, in fact, in the end of the day, split. Capital cases is inadmissible, civil cases not. Circumstantial evidence is not admissible, only evidence, compelling evidence that there's no other way whatsoever. That's the difference where we differentiate between, you know, the cases of Shimon ben Shaddach and the others, was where it's impossible versus possible. And when it comes to understanding people's behaviors and motivations, or whether they meant something or didn't mean something, that the basin does have the ability to use its discretion. And we saw an application for Moshe Feinstein, where it was even applied to a case where it was nothing to do with the Beis Din, but was dealing with somebody who was eating in his parents' home. The parents weren't keeping kosher, the child was. Presumably an adult person. And Rav Moshe did allow it because the person said, my parents, they're not here to get me, and they really, they're very sincere, and they really do respect my beliefs, and they will be careful, I know my parents. So he's allowed to do it, whereas I couldn't give that to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu keeps kosher, so I mean for that reason. But I can't give that level of credibility to Moshe Rabbeinu, even though I know from what I've heard about him and from what we know about him, because I don't know him personally. It comes from a personal recognition in that case. In other cases, it's that generally people act a certain way, and therefore that's admissible. But it's knowing either specific people or people in general that is allowed to be used in court.